and feel included. All right.
I like to be anonymous.
You like, okay, well, you can sit behind the post and I won't. My name's Jeremy Myers. I teach at Augsburg College in the religion department and oversee their youth ministry major. So I've been asked to come to the village and talk a little bit about youth ministry, which I love to do. So, and I love to be at Holden Village, so it's sort of a blessing for me to be here. Some of this will be repetitive for those of you who have been to other sessions I've led, so I apologize, but those of you who haven't been here, I want to kind of bring you up to speed a little bit too. So, the argument I'm trying to make this week is that our young people, and by that I mean children, youth, and young adults, need churches that are innovative and creative and public. Very much like what we experience here at Holden Village. Some of that Holden hilarity that you see where they'll ritualize, like they at this last presentation they were talking about the minor mediation and the bridge they're putting in down the road is almost done, right? So they want to have a blessing of the bridge and then they're going to try and have a dance on the bridge, right? So, you know, the village does weird things like that. But what I'm trying to say is that I think our young people need churches, faith communities, to do weird things like that publicly as ways of making meaning, as ways of understanding reality in a more hopeful way rather than a nihilistic way or a hopeless way. So that's essentially the argument I'm making in this presentation. So I'm talking about a handful of art forms, and today we'll be talking about an art form that I'm calling reflective practice, which by the end of the hour you should know what that means, if I do this right. So again, repeat for some of you who have been here, two major cultural shifts that have put us into the situation we're in right now, with the state of youth and religion. Two, I think, major cultural shifts that have caused that. First would be what I'm calling the privatization of religion. So, post-Enlightenment, science, the scientific method, human reason and rational discourse became the way in which communities were to make decisions publicly, okay? And over time, religion was pushed out of the public square. Up until that point, religion had a huge role to play in public decision-making. Post-Enlightenment, it started to get pushed back into the private world. So now, what you believe is okay, just keep it to yourself. You know, it's sort of a crass way of saying, a crass way of describing the way we think about religion today. So religion today is primarily thought of as a personal, private thing that you do on your own. My own personal relationship with Jesus, my own set of pious religious practices, but it's something we do on our own. Okay, so that's relatively new in the history of religion and humans. Okay, the other thing that's even more recent would be this emergence of adolescence as a life phase. So even the term adolescent, you know, is really, even though some of the early philosophers picked on young people in some of their writings, adolescence as a unique stage of life really didn't emerge until about 100 years ago. So the idea of a teenager is only about 100 years old. Prior to that, you were either what? Yeah, you were either a kid or you were an adult. And when did you become an adult?
About 13.
Okay, when you were strong enough, right, or physically, when you were physically able to do whatever it was you were physically supposed to do to be able to generally help your family out, right? You think, especially the Louisiana Purchase, I don't want to go into all this, I don't know why I am, but the westward expansion Young, if you were strong enough to swing an axe, you swung an axe, right? If you were strong, if you were able to move into the city, and this is where spinsters, if you heard the spinster term, comes from. Young women who are old enough to go to the city and work in the mills, the textile mills, right, and earn income and send money back home to the farm. So you were either a child or you were an adult. So this idea of this different phase of life where you're not a child and you're not an adult is only about 100 years old. These two things kind of create a perfect storm for us in religion, when it comes to religion. The privatization of religion and the privatization and the emergence of adolescence. So we start to think about the teenager as a bundle of chemical reactions, right? Hormones, raging hormones. Or we think of the teenager as a blank slate or a lump of clay waiting to be shaped by violent video games and sexy commercials and whatever else it might be, right? So this is a very limited way of understanding the human being as a Christian, I would say, as a religious person. We would also want to say more about the things that influence young people. We would also want to say, I think, that it's not just biology and it's not just culture that's has agency and power in the lives of our young people, but we would also want to say that God's Spirit is doing something there as well. So how then do we become a community, an intergenerational community of people who are helping our young people navigate those changes? So when we see the turmoil or the dissonance that goes on during the teenage years, we talk about the effects of culture, the effects of biology, but maybe God is, how do we come alongside of them and help them understand what God might also be doing in that phase of life as well? And I call that a vocational understanding of adolescence. So how do we move from this current way of thinking about teenagers or young people where they're completely self-centered and they don't care about the world, how do we move from there to what I would say is a vocational understanding of the young person that believes that they are deeply called by God to serve the world? And they sense that inside themselves, but might not know what to do with that, right? So they experience this sense of call, this deep compassion. They see the problems in this world, whether it's environmental, racial, whatever it might be, and they're moved by those, and they want to respond to those, and they might not know how to. So how do we come around them and the truth is many of us don't. I don't know how to do that either, right? So how do we come together as a community and start to work that out together, to work out, to ask one another, what's God's call for us here in this place? So vocational understanding of adolescence is to the privatization of adolescence as public church is to the privatization of religion. So what I'm saying is these two things are problematic, and these two things might be helpful for us right now. Thinking of the young person as a human being with a call from God to serve his or her neighbor. Okay, what if we thought of them as that first and foremost? What if we thought of the young person first and foremost as a human being with a unique call from God to serve his or her neighbor? What if that was the first way we thought about them rather than as violent, self-centered, maniacs running around, which is how we are sometimes, that's the way our culture talks about them usually. And how then do we as a church come around them and move into the public sphere with them and talk about God's call for us to serve God's world? So that's what we're talking about this week. This is my one sentence definition of what I mean by public youth ministry, which is an intergenerational faith community seeking to engage its context, its neighborhood, its community, its wilderness surroundings, right? That's Holden's context. An intergenerational faith community seeking to engage its context and express its faith in public and constructive ways. Because a lot of the public expressions of faith that young people see today are not constructive. A lot of the public expressions of faith young people see today are destructive and divisive. So how do we become communities of faith that express our faith publicly in constructive ways? Whether it's constructive expressions of anger, whether it's constructive expressions of celebration, of lament, whatever it might be, how do we do that constructively in a way with our young people that also benefits our context and benefits our community? So there are five art forms, and I'm using the term art form purposefully, because to me it's a little more open-ended than saying there are five practices or five ways you can do this, because let's look at the art form hanging above the screen, right? This is art. I'm assuming that's art, right? Probably not plumbing gone awry. I'm assuming that's a piece of art, right? I don't know. Maybe that goes to the shower somehow. I'm not sure. But if you are a sculptor, you might sculpt with clay. You might sculpt with, you know, copper tubing that you found left over, right? But no one would disagree that you're sculpting, right? So what I want to say is, these five art forms, accompaniment, which we talked about on Monday, which means how do we go out into our neighborhoods and actually learn about our neighborhoods? How does a church do that? Rather than just opening the doors and flipping on the lights and waiting for people to show up, what are some things a congregation can do to go out and learn and meet its neighbors and become a neighbor? Biblical imagination, how do we not just go and hear our neighbors' stories, but how do we go out there and hear their story and then put it into relationship to God's story? How do we hear the stories of our context, and how do we interpret those stories of our context biblically? And we've been hearing that in Vespers this week, right? Because there's a very unique thing going on here with this context. And we've heard the last two nights, the preachers in Vespers have given us, have used the biblical narrative to help us think, to reinterpret the reality that Holden Village is experiencing right now. That's more hopeful. It's still very realistic, but it's also hopeful, right? And then third, what we'll be talking about today is reflective practice. But how you do these things, I would say, I don't care. But what I want is for congregations to start to think about what are the gifts we have? What would be a way for us to enter? What would be a way for our congregation to accompany our context, our neighborhood, our community that makes sense for the way we do things, right? So that's what I mean by art forms, that you find your way to make art, to sculpt, rather than thinking it has to be done in this way. Your congregations establishing particular practices that make sense for your congregation and your setting, that moves your congregation out into the community for the sake of these art forms.
Speaking of art forms,
yes.
who did the piece?
Thank you. You know, and I should have written all that information down so I would remember. So don't quote me on this. This is a painting from a community, and I think it was from Ireland. It's a Christian community that's based on that. Their emphasis is faith and art. And this text, the Ezekiel text, is actually sort of the theme text of that community. So this is a painting that I found when I was kind of researching this text and whatnot. And I love it. I was joking the first day. I love it because it depicts the story, but it also looks like me. Right? The profile is... My beard's not quite that long yet. So we're going to look at this text now. And this text will be sort of a launching pad into this idea of reflective practice. I'll read this to you. You've heard this a lot, Right? This is good. We're steeping ourselves in this text this week. Then he brought me back to the entrance of the temple. There water was flowing from below the thresholds of the temple towards the east, for the temple faced east. And the water was flowing down from below the south end of the threshold of the temple, south of the altar. Then he brought me out by way of the north gate and led me round on the outside to the outer gate that faces towards the east, and the water was coming out on the south side. Going on eastwards with a cord in his hand, the man measured 1,000 cubits, then led me through the water, and it was ankle deep. Again he measured 1,000 cubits and led me through the water, and it was knee deep. Again he measured 1,000 cubits and led me through the water, and it was up to the waist. Again he measured 1,000, and it was a river that I could not cross, for the water had risen. It was deep enough to swim in, a river that could not be crossed. And he said to me, "Mortal, have you seen this?" Then he led me back along the bank of the river. So this is where we stopped when we were talking about accompaniment. This idea of entering into a relationship with the community, and then listening for those moments when the community turns to us and says, "Mortal, have you seen this?" Right. So an example I use is when I talk with youth ministers, the one thing, especially in the Lutheran Church, the one thing they're always kind of stressing about is post-confirmation retention rates, right? Oh, after confirmation, everyone stops coming to church, right? But the one thing they never talk about is childhood poverty rates, which is like 1 in 4 right now, right? 25% of children in our country live in poverty, right? So that's one of those moments when you hear that number. To me, that's one of those, "Mortal, do you see this? You know, wake up and smell the coffee. Why are you worried about post-confirmation retention rates when 1 out of 4 children in our country is living in poverty?" So how do we enter into our communities in a way that truly allows us to see the breadth and the depth of God's mercy and listen and to people pointing to not only the mercy of God, but also the real suffering that's there. As I came back, I saw on the bank of the river a great many trees on one side and on the other. He said to me, "This water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the Araba, and when it enters the sea of stagnant waters, the water will become fresh." And this is where we stop to talk about biblical imagination. God's water, the biblical narrative, mixing with our narrative and making it fresh. Wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live, and there will be very many fish. Once these waters reach there, it will become fresh, and everything will live where the river goes. So this is where I want to jump off today, reflective practice. How do we, as a congregation, with our young people, go looking for places where everything is living, right? How do we go reflective practice, not just teaching them content, not just teaching the biblical narrative, not just teaching confessional Lutheranism or whatever it might be that you're teaching, but how do we actually teach a methodology? How do we actually then show them how to live a life that uses this narrative and uses our theology to go into the world and find this life where it's happening? So that's where we will go today. Any questions so far? Thoughts? Just jump in as you wish. I'm going to put three diagrams in front of you right now that all look essentially the same. And then we're going to talk with one another. What is reflective practice? There are three ways I want to just describe this to you. The first would be experiential education. Does anyone have any experience with experiential ed? As a student or a teacher? Okay, some of you do. Service learning, maybe you've heard it called service learning. Okay. So Dewey really is the one who came up with this theory of experiential education, essentially learning from experience rather than learning from a textbook. All right, so how do you start the educational process with an experience, rather than, you know, reading in a textbook. And then Robert Kolb really later came up with, formalized this process of experiential education, where you begin by describing a concrete experience, which we've all had, right? Everyone's had an experience of some sort or another. So if you're working with young people, and David, I'm glad you're here. We're talking in a couple weeks. David's going to be leading a group of high school kids on a mission trip, right? So we were kind of talking the other day about, well, how do you unpack that? Well, here you go, right? You start with this experience that they might have, whether it's cross-cultural, whatever kind of experience it might be. The van breaks down, right? And then you move from the concrete experience to observation and reflection. So you sit with one another and you talk, what did we just see? What did we just experience? What went on? Let's try to recreate this experience and describe it so that together we really know what just happened. That moves into a stage of forming abstract concepts, trying to really understand what just, not just describe what happened, but understand it. Okay. Why is it, why do we think that A led to B, which led to C? Why did we react that way? Why were these people affected differently than these people? So you start to create theories, maybe, about why the experience happened the way it did. This is what I mean by teaching a methodology, right? So we start teaching our young people how to think theologically, how to interpret what's going on in their lives. And then the last stage, so to speak, not really last because it just keeps going and going and going, is testing those theories in new situations. So they go on a mission trip. You unpack that mission trip. You discuss the observation and the reflections. What did we experience? What did we learn? What happened? Why did it happen that way? What did you feel? How do you feel differently now? What do you know differently now? And then you start forming abstract concepts. Why do we think? What do we think was contributing to the poverty of these people we met on the mission trip? And then you start testing those in new situations. Now we're home in Battle Creek. And, you know, now how do these things we experienced in Chicago now apply to our life here in Battle Creek, Michigan, or wherever it might be where you're from? So it's using a real life experience. It's not just having an experience, but it's thinking deeply about that experience. So that's experiential ed, okay? Experiential education. Dewey kind of initiated that, formalized it. Paulo Freire, who wrote a book, Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and this is called Critical Pedagogy. Similar theory, but somewhat different in that Kolb and Dewey were really, their concern was the development of leaders and good learners, right? So they wanted to be descriptive of this learning process in order to generate good, strong leaders and strong learners. Freire had a different goal in mind, which was social transformation. Like, we don't just want good, strong leaders, and we don't just want good learners. We want to transform an oppressive culture, oppressive systems. So his was directed more towards social transformation than just changing a leader. But the same thing, you see, starting with experience, looking for patterns, adding new information and theory. And then he adds practicing skills and strategies. So it's not just creating a theory and then applying it, but there's actually a process of practicing it. Like, let's make sure we know how to do this before we go out there and actually do it. And then you apply it into action. And notice it's a spiral, right? So the thought is that it just keeps going and going and going as you apply it into action. As you apply it, number five, as you apply an action, then that action, that experience with that action becomes number one again, right? You start with the experience of the participants. This, another way of thinking about this in in religion and theology is something called practical theology. That's really blurry. Something called practical theology, which is quite similar, where you start with the descriptive, describing what has just happened, moving to the interpretive, why did it happen this way? Moving to the normative, and this is where I would say practical theology becomes a little different. The other ones, they're applying theories. They're trying to think of theories or create theories that might help them understand what just happened. Practical theology takes an intentional theological move here, where we start to ask ourselves, what is it from our tradition, biblical theological tradition, that might help us understand this situation, right? So, descriptive task, the minor mediation. Interpretive task, why is this happening? Normative task, that's what we've been experiencing. I would say we've been experiencing that in Vespers the last two nights, right? Where folks are digging deeply into the biblical narrative and finding ways to help that are normative to our tradition that help us think about this very real situation that we're all experiencing here at Olden Village. And then out of that becomes the strategic task. How now then do we live differently? How do we live differently because of this? What do we do now because of this experience? So before I move on, quick thoughts on this or questions about this. Why am I doing it? Why are we doing this? Does this make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, good. It's not rocket science, right? But it's the hard part about this is doing it intentionally with young people. And that's what I mean by saying that what I really want to talk about here is a methodology. First day we talked about accompaniment. Yesterday we talked about biblical imagination. Now we're talking about a methodology. How do we actually practice accompaniment with a biblical imagination? This allows us to do that. This is the methodology for that. This allows us to unpack experiences that happen to our young people and help our young people understand it, help them think about it theologically, help them think about it biblically, and help them articulate and create a proper response to what they experience, whether it's a tragedy that happens in their school, which is sadly quite common. And unfortunately, you know, Chris and I were talking about this, right? I think it was a young person died, and we were talking about this. A young person died, and someone was trying to figure out, are there any good ways to work through this with a group of young people who knew this person? And there are no examples I have of communities that have done that. Doesn't mean they're not doing it, but we don't know about those experiences. So what I want to try and do, all I want to do with the rest of our time here together is actually get you guys to practice this. Oh, I forgot about this. Probably an important slide. This is just a simple definition of theology that I really like that I wanted to share with you. And this is why I think this practice of reflective practice, this is why I think the art form of reflective practice is so important. Douglas John Hall defines theology as that ongoing activity of the whole church that aims at clarifying what gospel means what?
Good news,
right? That ongoing activity of the whole church that aims at clarifying what good news must mean here and now. The good news is good because it challenges and displaces bad news. So what does that mean? So what's the first step? If we want to proclaim good news to a community, if we want to proclaim good news to our young people, what's the first step, given this definition of theology?
Learning the good news or something?
Yep, knowing the good news.
Talking about the here and now.
Okay.
And the bad news.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Before I can tell you some good news, I kind of have to know your bad news, right? And good news for you might be different than it is for you because your bad news is different than your bad news, right? That's a step we usually don't take. We usually don't take that step of taking time to hear the bad news. This art form that we're talking about today takes that step seriously. How do we unpack the bad news? How do we describe the bad news and start to understand the bad news and start to think about the bad news theologically, biblically, so that we can embody new practices that proclaim good news that challenges and displaces that bad news. That's why this is important. And how do we do that with our youth? Yes?
Have them go dance on a brand new bridge.
Amen. Right, exactly. Have them go dance on a brand new bridge. Yep, absolutely. And to talk about why we do this.
Yeah.
Right? Sure. One reason why we do it is just it's fun and it's goofy. But there's another reason. Why else do we do that? Why else would we, as Christian people, dance on a bridge in the wilderness? Why else would we do that? What are some other reasons? How do we think about that theologically? What is it about? Let's take a second. We're doing the normative task now, okay? What is it about our tradition that makes us want to dance on a bridge in the wilderness?
It's a celebration of straightening out something that's bad.
Okay.
The beginning of making it new.
Sure, yeah.
It's a community activity.
Okay. And what is it about our Christian faith that makes us want to do that as a community activity? I mean, are there narratives, are there stories we can think of, or claims, theological claims we make that would make us think we should go dance on a bridge?
And David danced.
Huh?
And David danced.
David danced, yeah. You've seen Footloose.
Jeremy?
Yeah.
It's a really concrete celebration of the technical expertise and gifts of all the workers who safely and really beautifully, you know, maybe not aesthetically beautifully, but technically beautifully, made a bridge in a really difficult circumstance.
Right.
So we can claim that and celebrate that.
Right, and absolutely. And I immediately go to, and it doesn't take much to get me there, vocation.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
These gifts and skills, these technical skills that these men and women have to be able to pull this off, right here in such a difficult place. That God has gifted them for this moment and for this task. So here's what I would like us to do. I'm going to give you a moment, just a couple minutes alone here in this space, silently, to reflect on what I want you to do is conjure up an experience you've had recently that you think, I don't know how else to describe it, that you think is significant enough to reflect on it a little bit. So you might consider it a religious experience, a moment of enlightenment, however you might describe it. But an experience, it could be traumatic, it maybe not, maybe it was a good experience, but an experience you've had recently that you wouldn't mind spending a little bit of time unpacking right now. Because what I want to do is kind of practice this wheel that we were just looking at. Okay? So just take a moment and try to think of an experience that you've had recently that you wouldn't mind reflecting on for a few moments. Just think of it, and then I'll give you further instructions. know, this is the time of day you don't want a group of people to sit with their eyes closed too long. I hope you all thought of something, and now I'm going to give you an option. I would love it if you did this with a partner, talked through this experience with a partner, but that's an option. You don't need to do that. If you would like to do this with a partner, if it's an experience you don't mind talking about publicly with a partner, then find a partner and we'll work through these steps with your partner. If it's something you'd rather just kind of keep to yourself, that's totally fine, and you can just go through this on your own. Okay? That fair? All right. So what we'll do first is go ahead and find a partner if you want to work with a partner, and don't be embarrassed if you don't want to. If you don't want to, you don't need to. And try to keep it to partners just for the sake of time. A group of three just takes longer to get through. So try and keep it to just partners. Anyone want a partner who doesn't have a partner?
I accept.
Good? All right. So, here's the first step. This is the descriptive task of practical theology, okay? Take time with your partner, maybe just a minute or two if you can, to describe, a minute or two each, to describe the experience. What was going on? Who was affected? What were your reactions? All right, so just take a minute or two each and describe the experience that you're thinking. If you've not switched storytellers, you might want to do that now.
Okay.
it's hard to tell some of these stories in only 2 minutes. I understand that. The next step I would like you to take with your partner would be to take a couple minutes and work on interpreting the experience. Okay, so why do you think things happened this way? And why do you think you reacted this way? Or the way things unfolded, why do you think they unfolded that way? Why do you think whatever it was that happened that you talked about, why do you think that happened? Can you interpret that experience? Okay. So just try that for a couple minutes with your partner. This is totally the wrong thing. Like, if you were actually doing this with, I guess I am actually doing this with people, aren't I?
We're actually doing it.
You're actually doing it. Yeah, thank you.
We're just actually watching.
I know, and I'm actually rushing you. I'm sorry, but we're practicing, and these will carry on throughout the rest of the time today. But the third step with your partner would be now you move from interpreting why did it happen this way to understanding the experience. This is the normative task, okay? What is it in your own tradition? Maybe there's a biblical story, a parable, a theological claim that's important to you. What is it in your tradition that helps you understand this experience better? Is there anything in your tradition that you've been raised with that really helps you think about this experience in a helpful way? Okay, so take a couple minutes and work through that now with your partner.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay, the last step in this process. Okay, and if we're thinking like curriculum-wise, if you were to actually do this with a group of young people, what I'm giving you 2 minutes to do what I, you know, you maybe spend an hour doing. With now, I'm thinking if I have some kind of experience with a group of 10 kids, we'd spend an hour at least unpacking each one of these things, right? So number four, now with your partner in 2 minutes or less, how should you respond? How do you live differently now because of this experience you've had? How should you live differently now, thinking about it now theologically, biblically? What is your call? What's our call? What's our call in this situation? What's the invitation or the challenge in this situation, given our theological now take on?
Is this a what would Jesus do question?
No. It's a what would you do question. Okay, first question, what was this like? Other than rushed, I know that, I'm sorry. What was this like? Was it uncomfortable? What made it difficult? Was it easy? What made it easy? What was this like for you to do? Or, oh, I do this all the time, this was no big deal. What was this like?
One question I have. Sometimes I think it's hard to stay with description.
Yeah.
I'd be curious if other groups, that you right away, even as you're describing, you start interpreting.
Yeah.
And you don't really give a thick, that's not a great word, but you don't give a detail
enough.
Because you're so quick to start evaluating. Mm-hmm. That was something we noticed, and I wondered if other groups.
So in step one, you were already sort of doing step two or three,
right? Yeah, this is why this happened, but you haven't really...
Right. And yesterday when I talked about biblical imagination, I talked about this theologian who I like, Gustav Ingren, who talks about this way of interpretation that recognize, like, you can't really necessarily separate those two, because in your you've already interpreted in your description, and your interpretation is affected by what you deem to be normative, right? So it's really hard to just stick to that descriptive moment. But really important too, does the group clearly remember together what just happened and what people said and what we experienced? Right? Someone up there?
Oh, I was just going to say, always when you come to this type of situation, situation is what's your experience? Was my experience that I would want to share? Was it, you know, was it valid enough, or was it big enough, or was it important enough?
Yeah.
And I think sometimes, you know, with youth or, you know, my teenage daughter trying to talk about, you know, the experiences, bringing them out,
yeah,
and being able to, because everything's fine, good, you know. And, yeah, so trying to have tools to,
right,
to help express something that, you know, that you want to talk about more. And
right.
So this is helpful.
Okay, so this is gives you some tools to, right. And, you know, I have a 9-year-old and a 5-year-old, and I was really good at doing this with my 9-year-old before the 5-year-old was born. Now I have 2, I'm not so good at it. But I used to find ways to ask him these kinds of questions before bed, and it was totally strategic. So my hope was that if I did this with him while he was 3 and 4, that when he was 13 and 14, it would be normal and easy, and he'd be willing to do it with me. But if I try to start it when he's 13, he'll think I'm the weirdest thing, right, on the face of the earth. So, other reactions to this?
I think this would be helpful with adults too, to find ministry.
Yeah, absolutely. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do this with each other? When I was doing youth ministry in the congregation, I ran the youth committee where we'd come together and we'd make plans and we'd talk about who's going to get the hot dogs, and it was boring, and no one really wanted to be there, and everyone couldn't wait to leave. And then I realized that, and we were all sort of rotting on the vine together, right? So then we started to do this together, and it was amazing to see what happened to that community of adult and volunteers and youth who were involved in that group. It was amazing to see what happened to that leadership team, but then also to our ministry as well, right? So that we didn't, what I'm trying to say is, it's not like you plan ministry and then do ministry, right? You just live this life of discerning God's call with other people and try to understand what it is that's going on around us. So how would you see this happening? You said that one way, do this with adults too, but how could you see this happening with the young people in your congregation?
I think it depends on whether it's a life-changing event or not.
Sure.
I think if it's a life-changing event and you've gone past the terror of it or the excitement of it,
mm-hmm,
and you've had time to reflect, then I found these 4 steps to be, have already done much of it.
Sure.
Thinking back to our youth and our congregation, we've had a couple of not so much life-changing events for them, but we've had death occur,
mm-hmm,
by accident with one of the young people in our congregation, and with another, with a young mother,
mm-hmm,
by accident again. And the wrestling with that, and I know that they wrestled with it, they took it down. I'm not in the youth,
mm-hmm,
ministry at our congregation, but I know they spent time on working with,
mm-hmm,
the results of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think with something like that, these steps, particularly if they do it the day after and think their work is done, and then I think you've missed the opportunity.
Yeah.
But as you go beyond that, if you take steps like this,
mm-hmm,
and I guess the question I would ask is, if you pick something less life-changing, like, I don't know, just pick something less life-changing for a young person, I think they may be going on to the next experience.
Yeah.
I've lived that. I want to go on. That's kind of the way I meet youth sometimes. I don't know whether that's really relevant because I don't work with youth anymore.
Sure.
But
yeah. Well, I think it's true of all of us that, you know, we and also just the busyness of our lives. We're always sort of moving on to the next thing, right? So part of this is learning this reflective practice so that. You could do it on the fly. This is what I was just talking to David about. How do we learn how to do this well enough? Because he actually wrote about the van breaking down. You know, so how do we learn this well enough as a community that we can actually do it? Faith formation, discipleship, whatever you want to call it, on the fly. It's not something really that can be programmed, right? It's something that happens just in time, as experiences emerge and young people need us to help them unpack those experiences. So we're teaching them how to think theologically, and we're teaching ourselves how to think theologically about profound things, and I would also say mundane things as well. Well, yeah, and maybe it's helping me to, when you mentioned the youth minister saying the post confirmation retention rates
yeah.
dropped down.
Yeah.
I mean, if you ask those adolescents, they would say, because you have nothing else to give me.
Right.
You can't help me anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this gives a new way of saying, of tools for, yeah, looking at things happen to all of us. I mean,
right.
drop into your lives, and how do we deal with it, and how to deal with it, not just in a secular way,
mm-hmm.
but you know, how they can begin to bring, you know, form an adult faith.
Absolutely. Well, right, and to say to them, you do still need us, but also to say, and
we need you.
I need you to do this with me, right? So, well, thank you guys. I hope you just keep wrestling. How can we go home to our congregations with our young people and help them really, how can we get to know them so well that they'll trust us enough to do this with us? And once we have that relationship with them, how then do we start thinking theologically with them towards transformative proclamation of the gospel, of the good news that truly challenges and displaces the bad news? So, thanks. I'm sorry we ran over. Yeah, sorry about that.